Next case is 07-1292, John C. Grundy, Administrator versus Jagpreet Singh Dhillon. Mr. Pfau.
May it please the court, counsel. I would like to reserve 3 minutes rebuttal, Mr. Chief Justice.
Watch your timer on the clock.
My name is William Pfau. I represent the appellants in this case. Dr. Dhillon and the emergency group that he practices for. On behalf of Dr. Dhillon and the appellants, it is my purpose to reverse the decision of the 11th District Court of Appeals and request that this court do that and reinstate the decision of the trial court, and that's the perhaps smaller issue that's before this court today. I believe that the record supports that type of a finding for my clients, regardless of this court's adoption of the standard for dealing with this type of juror misconduct. We do, though, propose that this court adopt the holding from the United States Supreme Court's 1984 decision in McDonough, in which the Supreme Court held that in cases where on voir dire, a juror fails to disclose information in response to a question, that subsequent to trial and verdict, when that issue is raised on a motion for new trial, in order to prevail on such a motion, the moving party must establish that the juror's response was untruthful to a material question, and that if in fact the juror was untruthful, if the moving party meets that burden, that in that case, the answer, if given, if made known to the attorneys and the court during the voir dire process, would be a basis for a challenge for cause. The Supreme Court of Ohio has not dealt with this type of voir dire jury issue in quite a number of years. There was a little flurry of cases between 1940 and 1950. The result of those cases, for the most part, was to defer to the discretion of the trial court and affirm the trial court. And that was generally the effect of those cases. Subsequent to the McDonough holding, several appellate cases, and I think we've cited Dedman and Presley and Mullet, have stated the holding of McDonough, but they have not really expounded on it in any large extent. But we are here today asking this court to adopt the McDonough holding recognizing that it was a plurality decision of the United States Supreme Court, but that the holding in the court's opinion issued by Justice Rehnquist, and some of the reasons we think that should occur is because when we look at that standard, it is probably the most objective standard that courts have attempted to apply to this voir dire circumstance. And there were a number of reasons why the Supreme Court felt that was the right thing to do, not the least of which was the issue of judicial efficiency. The McDonough case was a 3-week trial. The case that's before this court today ran slightly over 2 weeks. So we've got 10 jurors and the judge and 2 staff people, and the court's time for two plus weeks. And I think the United States Supreme Court's sense was it ought to be something pretty significant and pretty clear if we're going to set aside proceedings in this day and age on an errant comment or lack of response from a juror.
Mr. Fowle, would you, this whole issue arose because of a statement the juror made to counsel after trial, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The evidence aliende rule, was this even a matter that should have gone further based on this conversation?
Your Honor, I believe the evidence aliende rule precluded that conversational evidence from being introduced to impeach the jury, the juror, and the jury's verdict. Mm-hmm. However, the information that was learned in that conversation that the juror had taken a child to this hospital about 4 years earlier served to, that fact, if you will, Your Honor, was never contested. The juror admitted that, and it could have easily been verified in a number of fashions. So that I believe that it is not precluded by Aliende Rule 606B Civil Procedure. It is not precluded by that to show that a juror didn't answer a question on voir dire. May I get a drink of water? I just...
Sure.
Long problem of mine, Your Honor. However, the rest of the information in that conversation was prompted, and as the record reflects, I think page 19 of the supplement, Mr. White in the evidentiary hearing says to this juror who's now testifying before the judge under oath. And Mr. White references essentially this language to Mr. Crusley, the juror. We were outside of the courthouse, and I was asking you questions about what your considerations were in making the decision you ultimately made in this case. Mm-hmm. That's excluded. Mm-hmm. And so all that discussion is excluded. And the trial judge, when he referenced the Aliende rule in his opinion, at the outset of his opinion, was correct in saying this type of information is barred by 606B. This is exactly what the question was. Mm-hmm. How did you reach your verdict? And the discussion from the juror was, here's how we did it. Whether that's actually how they did it or not, is always when you talk to jurors post-trial, they tell you sometimes what actually happened, and sometimes they tell you what they think you might want to hear. But nonetheless, that portion is excluded. But I do think that they can introduce some evidence from somewhere to show that this juror didn't answer a question, and that gets us to did he answer the question or not, and what's the standard to find juror misconduct?
And Mr. Pfau, I know we accepted three propositions of law, and it appears that from what you've been telling us that the second and third propositions regarding the truthfulness of the juror or the 606B, is you're not asking us to really accept any new prop or new rule of law, but that the first proposition you stated you wished us to adopt the McDonough holding.
Correct, Your Honor.
So that is really where, as an appellant, your real argument is with the first proposition.
That is, I think, the larger issue for this court's concern is, is this court going to adopt the standard in McDonough, and if it does, in exactly what fashion, it being a plurality decision? There are many other states, and I think I've listed a number of them, that have in fact just outright adopted that holding. A number of the circuits have just followed that holding. Justice Blackmun's dissent gave a little wiggle room where there would be more discretion and a little broader interpretation. The
counsel, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the factual context here. I assume this was probably recorded by a court reporter rather than an electronic system.
Yes.
There's some question in terms of whether the juror may have known that he was still supposed to answer the question, because it looks like the question was asked, another juror responded, there were some comments by counsel, and then it doesn't appear that there was, or at least if it was, I forgot, counsel coming back to the jurors and saying anybody else to sort of renew the question to the rest of the jurors. So could you comment on that?
Right, and this is an issue, and some of the cases that have dealt with McDonough and this issue have, I've cited a couple of them in the brief, Pineview Farms and I think the Buckham case, other state cases, have talked about, as a threshold, a due diligence requirement, that it's the moving party's duty to show that they diligently inquired. Now, what we have here, Your Honor, as you've inquired, a series of questions by Mr. White, the plaintiff's counsel in the case. One actually, have any of you been patients? Anybody here been patients at the hospital? Five or six said yes, and they discussed briefly. After Juror Cruzley discussed his being a patient, Mr. White then said something like, anybody else had any experiences? Which reasonably would exclude the last jurors he just talked to. So no further response there. Then Mr. White said, discussed an experience one of the jurors had, and he said, essentially, I see I'm about out of time, but let me wrap up. He said, essentially, have you ever taken a family member? I don't know whether he said that to that juror. He probably said it to the panel. One juror said yes. White said anything about that. There was no response. And then he went into a monologue, which is about two or three pages of the transcript, which ends with, what do you think about emergency rooms leasing out their space? I'd like to reserve a
Mr.
couple Fowle,
minutes. Let me ask you before you sit down. Wasn't there a judicial trial court determination on that issue, though, resolving that issue by the trial court at that hearing?
The trial court's decision was that Juror Cruzley did not give any false information. He may not have answered, he may not have volunteered things if other specific questions were asked of him.
Which prompts your second proposition of law that, in this instance, the appellate court substituted its judgment for the finding by the trial.
We believe they clearly did. They went here, and they went here, and they jumped to here, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fowle. Chrisson.
Mr. Chief Justice, may please the court. I'm Jim Chrisson. I represent the appellee in the case, the estate of Susani Sumner. The decision of the 11th District Court of Appeals in this case should be affirmed, and it should be affirmed by this court regardless of whether the court adopts the McDonough test as syllabus law or follows the well-established Ohio law that preceded the McDonough case, and under either standard, the touchstone principle is the same, and that is that if a juror withholds material information during voir dire, and as a result, the complaining party is deprived of the right to seat a fair and impartial jury in the case, then a new trial should be granted. And that is the resounding principle whether McDonough is applied.
Counsel, could you explain how the plaintiff was disadvantaged by the presence of Mr. Crusley on the jury?
Your Honor, this was a medical malpractice case, as I'm sure you're aware, and the first question that the jury was asked in interrogatories was whether or not the emergency room doctor met the applicable standard of care. Mr. Crusley, by comments that he made afterwards, had experienced a strikingly similar circumstance when he took his own child to this same emergency room that was the defendant in this case, and concluded that the doctors had not adequately assessed his son and left and took him to another hospital where he felt the correct diagnosis was made. Mr. Crusley said that as a result of this experience, that his opinion was that the standard of care at that hospital was low compared to other hospitals, and further, that everyone in the community should know that the standard of care at that hospital is low, and therefore, the decedent's family in this case should have taken her away from that hospital to another hospital. So it's clear that he had a preconceived notion, as the Court of Appeals says in their opinion, about what the standard of care was at that hospital, and it was in a case where he was asked to evaluate that standard of care.
Counsel, is that the test that was it, is there a different standard of care for different emergency rooms?
No, Your Honor, there's not.
There's one standard of care, whether it's a highly renowned hospital or one that may not be as well known or as large, correct?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
So this juror's opinion that this wasn't a very competent hospital is what it translates to. If he was instructed, and I'm presuming the instruction was, this is the standard of care, there was testimony on what the standard of care and any deviation from that standard of care, correct?
That's correct.
So I'm still at a loss as to how this gentleman having a low opinion of the capabilities of the hospital wasn't, I mean, reasonably, I would think that that would be a benefit to the plaintiff.
Well, at first blush, Your Honor, that's an appealing argument because it seems like if you leave the opinion at the standard of care is low at that hospital, that would be beneficial to the plaintiff. But the further consequence of his opinion was that everybody knows the standard of care there is low, and therefore you should have taken her away from that hospital and taken her someplace else.
But Mr.
The bias in this case is that the plaintiff was deprived of the ability to have that information during voir dire and decide whether or not this was an appropriate juror to sit on the case.
Okay, but Mr. Chrisson, all the statements regarding the opinion of this juror that you've just mentioned come after the jury verdict and in violation of 606B.
Your Honor, I disagree that it's in violation of 606B.
Well, it says that a juror would be precluded from testifying as to these matters.
Well, Evidence Rule 606B specifically says that a juror will be precluded from testifying about matters that have to do with his assent to the verdict or his state of mind or emotions in coming to that decision. But the courts have held previously that those sorts of statements are admissible for purposes of deciding whether or not there was juror misconduct during voir dire. The Farley versus Mayfield case that we cite in our brief, as well as Mazzora versus H. Meyer Dairy Company, both hold that these statements were not admitted for purposes of showing that the juror acted in some way in the deliberations or in the jury room. These statements were admitted for the purpose to show that he had failed to disclose material information during voir dire, and that as a consequence of that, he had a bias or a predisposition that inured to the prejudice of the plaintiff and should have been disclosed.
Wouldn't your case be stronger if there was a direct statement or a direct question to Mr. Crousley that he failed to answer, or that he answered improperly? Here, if you look at the record, it appears that these were general questions to the panel at large. As Justice Cupp pointed out, some individuals answering the questions not being renewed again to the panel at large. So it seems like it's a big stretch now to say that this particular juror, one of the group that was being questioned, was dishonest.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree in the sense that it was not just one question that the juror failed to answer. The appellant focuses on the question, and agreeably it's the most important one, have you taken any of your family members or had any experience with any family members at Trumbull Memorial Hospital? And he did not respond to that question.
But it wasn't asked, as the dissent points out, it wasn't asked of him directly. It appears here as if the attorney asked the question, that question, and a juror responded yes. He then explored the details of that, and then the lawyer moved on with another set of questions. And I suppose, you know, we would be placing quite a burden on a juror to say, well, you should have raised your hand and said, Mr. White, I have something I want to tell you. I mean, the attorney controls the voir dire. It's a lot to say that Mr. Crousley was dishonest by not answering a question that wasn't posed to him, isn't it? That's what the dissent says.
I would respond to that in two ways. First of all, if the standard is dishonesty, then Ohio courts have held previously that dishonesty does not merely mean that you lie while you're answering questions on voir dire. Dishonesty can also be omissions and failure to disclose information, and that information is just as prejudicial as a lie.
But counsel, isn't that with the intent to deceive?
Let him finish the question, please. Go ahead.
And secondly, Your Honor, in this case, the juror did not answer the question when other panel members did. Much later during the voir dire process, there were, if I recall correctly from the transcript, four other jurors who related similar negative experiences at the hospital emergency room, three of whom were excused for cause. And during that entire period of time, Juror Crousley never once volunteered the information that came out after the trial. Earlier in the case, he had responded to general questions to the panel as to what his opinion about attorneys were, as to what his opinion about malpractice suits were. He responded to a general question to the panel about whether he himself had ever been treated at the emergency room at Trumbull Memorial. So there was not just one opportunity for him to disclose this information. There were multiple opportunities throughout the course of the voir dire, and it can be concluded from his testimony at the hearing on the motion for a new trial that at the very least he remembered this assuming that he didn't remember it during voir dire, which frankly is not credible, he at the very least admitted that at some point during the trial, he remembered an incident that was strikingly similar to what the entire case was about, and at that point still never mentioned anything to the court or to the attorneys or to anybody else about his prior experience.
If we were to affirm, we would probably need, that would be a statement, I guess, or an act of ours that would say we're not going to adopt McDonough as the test. Do you agree with that or not?
Your Honor, I think that this court could adopt McDonough as the standard and still affirm the Court of Appeals. I believe that the Court of Appeals succinctly cited McDonough and applied it correctly to the facts of the case. The first element of McDonough is, did a juror fail to honestly answer a material question? Now, the appellant would have you make a cramped reading of that first element and say that a failure to answer honestly means that he told a lie and doesn't include omissions.
Counsel, let me ask again then, does that omission have to be with an intent to deceive, or is it just forgot? Is there a difference there?
Well, there's no difference in the effect that it has on the ability of the plaintiffs to seat a fair and impartial juror. There is a difference in the respect that the courts have held, the Ohio courts that have discussed this issue, the Petro versus Donner case, the Cleveland Railway Company case, the Steiner versus Custer case. In all of those cases, the court made a point to say that there was nothing in the record that indicated that there was an intentional misrepresentation made by the jurors, but the fact that the information wasn't disclosed was held to be prejudicial and required a new trial at any case.
Mr. Christen, what about the idea that, as you pointed out, the voir dire process is a very fluid one. There are a lot of things going on. The credibility is a matter of determination to be made. Why should it not be the trial judge's call on this? And especially the dissenting judge in the 11th District seemed to emphasize the fact that the trial judge made a ruling that there was no improper conduct on the part of this juror.
Your Honor, I think what you're asking is how did the trial court abuse its discretion, if that's what I'm
That's a better way of saying it,
okay.
How?
And my response to that, Your Honor, is twofold. First of all, I agree with you that the trial court is in the best position in these situations to decide whether or not there was a failure to disclose that was material and whether it was a bias.
And it has to be more than the disagreement of the Court of Appeals abuse of discretion.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and I think that there was an abuse of discretion in this case, and particularly because the trial court made a point in its ruling to say that it would not consider any of the statements that were made by Juror Crusley after the trial was over on the courthouse because the trial court considered that to be in violation of Evidence Rule 606B. The Court of Appeals held that it was error for the trial court to have prohibited those statements and that they should have been considered. And that's where the abuse of discretion comes in partially, that the court made an error of law in that respect, should have considered those, and that resulted in it abusing its discretion. I would also say that the court seemed to, the trial court in its judgment entry, seemed to place great emphasis on the fact that Juror Crusley testified that he wasn't biased. And the courts that have adopted McDonough and discussed the McDonough standard have said that the courts shouldn't simply rely on a juror's subjective claim that they were unbiased. Of course, that's what a juror is going to say when they're asked that question. But if you look at every other circumstance in the case, as Justice Brennan says in his concurring opinion in McDonough that you should do, if you look at every other question, every other opportunity on voir dire that this man had to disclose this information, it's clearly an abuse of discretion, unreasonable and arbitrary for the court to decide based on his statement alone that it was forgotten and that he wasn't biased. Your Honors, I have one last point to make as I see my time is running out, and that is that we are requesting that the court affirm the Court of Appeals, but at the same time, should you decide to adopt the McDonough test and decide that that is a different test than the one the Ohio courts have applied, then we would respectfully request that you remand the case to the trial court to reevaluate the motion for a new trial based on the standard that the court sets forth in the opinion it will write in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Christen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Fow, you've saved almost a minute of your time.
Court, please. This issue of the juror's opinion of standard of care, I would like to point out to the court that there was never any question in voir dire asked of any of these jurors about what they thought about the standard of care at the hospital. And in fact, the judge in his preliminary remarks told the jurors that they would have to decide standard of care, but that would be explained to them by expert witnesses in the case. The reliance by the appellees and the appellate court as well on this issue of standard of care seems completely disconnected from the questions and answers that are in dispute here.
What is your response to Mr. Christen's statement that the juror, Mr. Cruzley, had several opportunities to respond to the question to which he didn't respond when it was initially raised by the lawyer?
He responded from the record to the questions that were asked of him. Later on, the way Judge Stewart, at least in this case, does the voir dire is a standard way where everybody's picked and then these people are seated and then individuals are brought up from the back of the room. Some of those individuals are then questioned, and some of them, the three that were excused for cause, said, I can't be fair in this case. I was at the hospital, I had a bad experience, or I had this, or I had that, I would favor one. So those three were excused because they came up and said, I can't be fair. The fourth one was one of the alternates, said, I had a bad experience at the hospital and my mother has a lawsuit against the Cleveland Clinic, but I think I can be fair. And they didn't challenge her or ask that she be excused for cause. I removed her with a peremptory challenge to the alternate. Once the juror is seated, I know of no instruction they get to come forward later on in the trial if something occurs to them. Sometimes they do.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
The way in which voir dire was conducted, and as Justice Lanzinger indicated, there's a lot going on, and it's easy for counsel to miss the nuances of what jurors are telling them, and the questions that were put seemed to be somewhat inartful. A broader question of, have you ever had a family member with an experience at the hospital rather than did you take a family member, because you could have a family member with a bad experience, mm-hmm. but you didn't take them there, so you could not hold, you wouldn't have to hold up your hand in
right.
face of that.
Well,
but jumping ahead yeah. to the Supreme Court test in McDonnell, this juror, at least an argument that was presented in response to Justice O'Connor's question, was that this juror's view was based on his experience with his child, is that the standard of care at this hospital is so lousy that this person should have known better than to go to the emergency room. Now, that may be an exaggeration of what this juror was saying afterwards, but if that was the juror's unexpressed view, wouldn't that be challenged for cause under the U.S. Supreme Court test if we were to adopt
it under under the McDonough test,
if yes. were
assuming that he withheld that information yeah. with intent.
I mean, if that was his private view and he withheld it, that...
I think that question, generally, the way it would be handled if you had that information is probably further inquiry would be made by the court and or counsel to determine.
Well, yeah, I've seen judges try to rehabilitate people well, who say
or,
awful
or
things.
Or to find out just what he means yeah. by that. The fact of the matter with this juror is that what was represented is, I mean, what he said is in the record. It's not exactly the way it was presented here today, I don't think. But what jurors like this juror tend to do is they're listening to all this evidence and then they're asked to explain how you got your decision and they make an explanation, and that's what was presented to the trial court as evidence of his bias. And whether that explanation was something that he had before the trial or not is not at all clear from the record.
Your view is his post-trial statements are mm-hmm. merely in a way to explain, a perverse way to explain away the verdict. I mean, he couldn't have been listening to any of the charge, I wouldn't think, if
he listened,
you conclude it was apparently her fault for going to this awful
right.
place.
If I may answer that question.
Yeah.
In this case, and I think I referenced this in the briefs, one of the issues when you discharge a patient from the emergency room that comes back sometime later very ill is how sick were they when they left? And you have family members talking about how sick she was, and you have hospital people saying her status was improved, vital signs were improved, she wanted to go home. So you have this evidence. The juror, in dealing with an explanation to Attorney White of this evidence, one of the things that he said was, well, if she was that sick, I would expect the family to take her someplace else. That's the kind of thing jurors tell you. Does it track with the law or what we, no, it doesn't. But that's what jurors do in deliberations, is they rationalize this.
Well, I'm trying to bring you back to if we were to adopt the U.S. Supreme Court test.
Right.
Some of the testimony that you have from this juror post-trial would...
I can answer your question.
Could lead you to believe this is, if that had been revealed, would be the basis for excusal for cause.
Under the McDonough test, my understanding of that test, the only thing that is referenced with respect to cause is the question that's not answered. So if he said, yes, I took a child to the emergency room, and Mr. White followed up and said anything about that, if he said, well, I wasn't real happy with the care, I don't know how far it would go, but the only thing to justify cause would be that he said, yes, I took my child to the emergency room. All this other stuff, I think, goes beyond the scope of McDonough, and that's the Sixth Circuit in Zirka. One of the things that they lauded about McDonough was it eliminates all of this, they called it guessing game, I call it speculation. It eliminates all this stuff that we really don't know what we're talking about. We're just guessing about
so
what could happen.
The line would be drawn at the failure to reveal, I took my child.
Yes, Your Honor, that's
what
I believe.
Would we have to remand this case for the trial court to apply McDonough if we were to reverse?
I think not, because I think the trial court, even though he referenced the Allende rule, he then went on to make two factual findings. One, that this juror was not dishonest, that at worst he didn't remember based on the evidence, and secondly, that there was no prejudice to the moving party, so that the substance of the requirements to meet McDonough are in the trial court's decision here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fowle. Case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.